Today's speakers are Bob Maxey and Dick Kremisek. Bob is an environmental engineer in the Office of Solid Waste Corrective Action Programs Branch. He has a BS in chemical engineering and is a registered professional engineer. Mr. Maxey has been with the EPA for 8 years, working in areas of corrective action and hazardous waste identification. Prior to his work at EPA, he was a consulting engineer where he designed groundwater pump and treat systems, biological wastewater treatment plants, and wastewater unit operations. He's also worked in synthetic fuels productions and nuclear waste management. Vic Kremisek is from Atlantic Richmill Company, a EP-affiliated company. He has provided technical support on remediation of contaminated service stations to Superfund sites for the last 16 years. In the past 3 years, he has worked extensively on LNAPL technology development with industry, EPA, and various states, and on the evaluation of the vapor intrusion pathway. He is a member of the Advisory Committee for the Soils Groundwater Technical Task Force of the American Petroleum Institute. He received a PhD in chemical engineering from Northwestern University in 1975 and a BS in chemical engineering from the University of Illinois at Champaign in 1969. This training has been given in classrooms probably a dozen times, and this is our first internet seminar, so we welcome any comments. And if you're interested in having this training given live, you can contact Bob or myself. And before I turn it over to Bob, let me remind you one more time, please put your phones on mute. If you don't have a mute button, hit *6 now, and don't put us on hold. Okay, Bob, are you ready?
I am, Ellen.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Ellen. Welcome. The RTDDF NAPL Cleanup Alliance has prepared this course on light non-aqueous phase liquids, or LNAPLs, and their impacts on the subsurface. And I'll be referring to these as NAPLs, just to simplify things. And the course provides a basic description of the behavior of NAPLs in the subsurface. It helps explain what many have observed in the field for years. As LNAPLs are removed from the subsurface, they are increasingly difficult to recover. And the course will be useful to regulators who evaluate work plans, hydrogeologists who make quantitative predictions about NAPL volume migration and recovery, and anyone who needs basic information about the nature of petroleum hydrocarbons in the subsurface. About halfway through my presentation, I'll be quoting from Fetter's Contaminant Hydrology about the behavior of NAPLs and monitoring wells. And this book, Fetter's Contaminant Hydrology, has many of the concepts that are in our presentation here, and this is pretty much state-of-the-art in understanding about how NAPL behaves in the subsurface. We think it's a very good description of how NAPL behaves and leads to improvement in understanding. Okay, we're on to slide 2, the NAPL release, and this shows a cross-section of the subsurface, including the top of the aquifer. I'm sure it's familiar to most geologists. And as we have a depiction of a release source at the top of the slide, it could be a barrel of oil or a gasoline station in small spills, or it could be a much larger source, such as you'd see at a fuel terminal or a petroleum refinery. As the petroleum hydrocarbons are released, they migrate through the vado zone, the unsaturated zone, and eventually contact the water table. In the absence of a petroleum spill, which hopefully is the situation all the time, the water is pulled upward into the vado zone, into the capillary fringe. The degree that it's pulled up is a function of particle size. And below the water table, the saturation of the water in the subsurface is 1. And we'll be looking at these concepts about capillary fringe, water table, and the degree of saturation later on as we go through the presentation. So we're moving on to slide 3. Which is the course outline. And this is a pretty good description of what we'll be looking at over the next 2 hours. In this course, we'll go over the basic information about NAPL and how it behaves on the subsurface. We will begin by defining important terms to provide a foundation for a focus on NAPL. You will learn how our understanding of the behavior of NAPL and the subsurface has changed over the years. We will also explore how aquifer properties like porosity, saturation, and capillary pressure affect NAPL distribution. As we progress through the course, you will learn how the fluid properties like viscosity, density, and interfacial tension and surface tension affect NAPL distribution and recovery. NAPL distribution and its saturation determine its conductivity, which in turn influences its migration and potential hydraulic recovery, which we'll see towards the end of my part of the presentation. Vic Kremisek will also introduce methods of predicting and evaluating NAPL recovery, briefly discuss some assessment methods, and we've got some methods that we think are current, quickly implemented, and also relatively inexpensive compared to traditional assessment methods. Finally, Vic will present 5 case studies to illustrate how the basic concepts you've learned have been applied in the real world. We're moving on to the next slide, slide 4, about what is NAPL. NAPL is non-aqueous phase liquid. It includes petroleum hydrocarbon products and chlorinated compounds. L-NAPL, which is the basic subject of our presentation, is NAPL that is less dense than water, generally petroleum hydrocarbon liquids such as gasoline. D-NAPL is a dense non-aqueous phase liquid, and that's NAPL that is denser than water, generally chlorinated hydrocarbon compounds, and they're not addressed in this course. However, many of the principles that we're talking about today can be applied to D-NAPLs with the understanding of the obvious difference that D-NAPLs are denser than water. The next slide, slide 5, which is the conceptual understanding of NAPL, shows what, for most of the last 20 years, we've used for the evaluation and recovery of NAPL, in which the NAPL floated on the water table like a pancake, displacing nearly all the water and the air in the pore space of the aquifer. Under this model, the result was a uniformly high saturation of NAPL on the water table. And as we'll see in slides later in my portion of the presentation, that's not a good assumption that the NAPL doesn't saturate the subsurface to 100%. Although many people recognize that there was a difference between the thickness of the NAPL measured in the monitoring well and the actual thickness in the aquifer, the tools needed for understanding this relationship and how it varied with the type of L-NAPL and aquifer had yet to be developed. People believe that when petroleum hydrocarbon was observed in the well, it was spreading. They also believe that NAPL moved up and down with a fluctuating water table, always riding on top of the water table. We'll move on to the next slide, please. Slide 6, which is the changing face of NAPL. The quantitative understanding of petroleum distribution in the subsurface media and its recovery was developed in the 1930s at Princeton and other universities, particularly applied to the distribution of petroleum and subsurface reservoirs from which we recover it. This understanding established the role of interfacial and capillary forces in determining the distribution of oil in subsurface media and led to the development of methods for describing the conductivity and recoverability of petroleum from oil reservoirs. Moving on to the next slide, slide 7, the changing face of NAPL. There's a micro photograph in the lower right-hand corner of this slide, and notice the scale on there, a scale of 1 millimeter, and it shows soil grains along with pore spaces and shows the wetting fluid, which is typically water, preferentially contacting the soil and occupying the smaller pore spaces. The larger green shaded material is the non-wetting fluid, NAPL or air, which tends to occupy the larger pore spaces. And this is one of the concepts that we'll be dealing with as we go through our presentation, that the wetting fluid, the water, occupies the smaller pore spaces. So As a result of the 1990s research, we believe that the NAPL coexists with water and the pore network within the aquifer. The degree of NAPL saturation depends upon lithology and fluid properties, and we'll be going over those later in the presentation. As I mentioned, the NAPL only partially fills the aquifer pore space. Saturations decrease with depth until water fills all the pores, and we'll be going over several saturation curves. Variations in NAPL saturation can be predicted depending on the subsurface media and also the NAPL properties. And the free NAPL volume, migration potential, and recoverable volume can be predicted. Moving on to the next slide, slide 8, NAPL distribution. Let's move on to discuss the aquifer properties that affect NAPL air and water distribution in the subsurface. Understanding how air and water interact in the subsurface will help you determine how much NAPL exists and how much of it can be recovered. First, we will review the basic concepts of porosity and saturation. Then we will discuss capillary pressure, the factor which governs the interaction of water and air in the subsurface. Move on to the next slide, please, slide 9, which is porosity. Porosity is the ratio of the volume of void space to the total volume of the porous media. In other words, porosity is the fraction of the total volume that is occupied by pore space. Total porosity depends on many factors, including particle size and shape, particle size distribution, and packing of particles. Clays generally have a high total porosity, 40 to 70%, while coarse grain material like sand and gravel have a lower total porosity. Total porosity accounts for all pore space, even pore space where water molecules are held very tightly in place by either capillary or other polar or nonpolar forces. And this holding of the water by these capillary forces explains why more liquids flow from low porosity materials such as sand than from high porosity materials such as clays. And another concept that we'll be dealing with later in my part of the presentation is permeability, specifically relative permeability, which is the capacity for transmitting fluids. And because the liquids, whether they're NAPLs or water, are held by these interfacial forces in the clays much more than they are in the sands, the higher porosity materials don't necessarily have a higher permeability. The total porosity is typically called the primary porosity. Often in clays, small fractures, wormholes, or root borings may develop. The void space created by these fractures is called secondary porosity. Secondary porosity typically has a low capillary pressure. While it generally constitutes a very small percentage of the total porosity, it can significantly influence the flow of fluids through clays. And we'll see this in a couple examples and some photographs later on in the presentation. And these provide an important channel for liquids, whether they're NAPLs or water, to flow through clays, even though the clays have got a low porosity. Moving on to the next slide, slide 10, which is saturation. The pore space that can be filled by different fluids that are immiscible with water is called the saturation. The fraction of the pore space that is occupied by a given fluid phase is called the phase saturation, and we'll be looking at some slides that have both NAPL and water saturation depicted. Saturation is represented as a fraction or a percent, and the sum of which a total 1 or 100%. Below the water table, and in the absence of NAPL, the saturation is nearly 1 and the air saturation is nearly 0. As you move from the saturated zone to the capillary fringe, the water saturation decreases from 1 to a value that represents the amount of water that is held within the medium by capillary forces. Moving on to the next slide, slide 11, sharing pore space with water. As I mentioned earlier, typically in the subsurface, water preferentially wets or adheres to the solid media surface and occupies the smaller pores. It is called the wetting phase and wets the surface of the solid media in preference to air. Air is called the non-wetting phase. Next slide, which is capillary pressure. as you move from left to right on this capillary pressure depiction, imagine that you're moving from a gravel or a gravel to a sand to a silt to a clay. Capillary pressure is defined as the pressure in the non-wetting phase minus the pressure in the wetting phase. When tubes of different diameters are placed in a dish containing water, the water will rise in each tube in relation to the surface tension between the air and the water and the radius of the tube. As the pore size gets smaller, reflected in the smaller diameter holes, the capillary rise gets bigger, meaning that the capillary pressure is higher. The capillary pressure is balanced by the pressure from the height of the column of water. You can view this another way as well. In porous media, the smallest pores will take in water first and hold it the tightest. It takes significant pressure to get the water out of the smallest pores. This is why coarse sands and gravels have a relatively small capillary fringe, while silts and clays have a large capillary fringe and hence stay moist. Moving on to the next slide, which is slide 13, shows characteristic capillary pressure curves. On the x-axis, we're plotting saturation from 0 to 100%, and on the y-axis, we're plotting capillary pressure in centimeters of water. The curves show the capillary pressure from coarse sand through fine sand all the way up to clay, and they're a graphic representation that clays have a much higher capillary pressure than do the coarser materials such as the sand. You'll also notice that the clay has got a steeper slope than the sand does. So this indicates that the pore sizes in the sand are larger than the clay, which is consistent with the capillary rise experiment discussed on the previous slide. And the coarse sand curve is very flat over a wide range of water saturations. This indicates that the pore size distribution is uniformly large for the sand.
Bob, this is Vic Kremisek. I'll give you a little break here, and I'll just
expect
a comment or two. Give you a chance to catch your breath. The way this experiment is run is you start out with a soil which is about 100, which has 100% water in it, and then you inject the non-wetting phase fluid into it, and it takes pressure to get that non-wetting phase fluid, whether it's air or elmapple, to move into the soil. So what happens is you've got a core filled with water, just like a saturated zone, and then elmapple or air comes down into that saturated zone and tries to displace the water. In the clay, the water is held very tightly in the fine-grained material, and it's very difficult to get the air or the elmapple to move into it. But in the sand, it's not held as tightly because the pore throats are much larger, so you can displace the water more easily. So that's kind of a different way to look at the curves.
Thanks, Vic. I appreciate the break. Moving on to slide 14, we show that capillary pressure works the same for water and apple and apple air. And we've got three representations of different phase systems here. We've got water air on the left, water and apple in the center, and apple air on the right. And in each one of those pairs, we've got a small diameter tube and a large diameter tube representing the height that the water would be drawn, the wetting fluid would be drawn into the media. So with all three phases, or all three figures, the smaller diameter tube has a larger rise of the wetting fluid, whether it's water or napple. The rise of the water is the greatest in all three of these cases, and it is smaller for the larger diameter material. Moving on to the right side of the curve, you have the napple and the air, and the napple rises via capillary action, but not as high as it does for the water air figure, because the interfacial tension is not as great for the napple air as it is for the water air system. And you have an intermediate situation where you have water napple, where they're where the pressure or the density of the napple tends to a greater degree than what the NAPL air system to suppress the water in the KERS. I meant the water air system. Moving on to the next slide, slide 15, the movement of NAPL into and out of pores. It takes pressure for NAPL to move into or out of pores. To move in or out of these pores, a droplet may encounter pore throats that are smaller than the droplet size. Sufficient pressure must be exerted to deform the droplet for it to move through the pore throat. The situation is illustrated in this slide. In the upper figure, the pressure gradient is too low to deform the NAPL droplet and allow it to move through the pore throat. In the lower figure, the pressure is sufficient to deform the droplet and make it mobile. In this scenario, the NAPL is recoverable. Difficulty in overcoming the pressure gradient is the reason why NAPL fills large pores first in a water-wet soil. It is also why some NAPL is trapped in pores during recovery and cannot be removed using hydraulic recovery methods such as pump and treat. So we'll be considering this figure in two different situations in our presentation. One where the NAPL is filled and is entering the subsurface media, and the hydraulic head needs to be enough to overcome this capillary pressure that we discussed in the previous slide. And the second one, is where we are trying to recover the NAPL from the subsurface media, and we also need to overcome that capillary pressure. Okay, moving on to the next slide, slide 16, displacement entry pressure. This equation shows the capillary pressure that must be overcome for a non-wetting NAPL to enter water saturation is called the displacement entry pressure. We'll be looking at that in a couple figures. The pressure in the NAPL phase is primarily related to the depth from the top of the water to the NAPL, the head, and the continuity of the NAPL above the water table. We don't need to go into all the details of this slide because of our limited time, but do notice that the displacement entry pressure is proportional to the surface tension, sigma, in the numerator of this equation, and it's inversely proportional to the radius of the particle, r, which is in the denominator of the equation. Okay, moving on to the next slide, slide 17, for drainage and imbibition capillary pressure curves. This is a pretty important concept, and some of these concepts from this curve or from this figure will be shown later in our presentation. This figure shows what we call the complete drainage history of a NAPL and water situation, or NAPL water situation in the subsurface. For the NAPL to enter the subsurface, it has to have enough displacement entry pressure, as we've just discussed, to be able to displace water from the pores, and that's shown on the right-hand side of the graph. And as the NAPL occupies more and more of the space in the subsurface, and the water occupies less and less, the figure goes along the drainage lines there to the point where it reaches what's called an irreducible water saturation on the left-hand side of the curve. And at that point, the water is held in place by capillary action and can't move, and the NAPL occupies most of the pore spaces. Coming back along this curve, it follows an imbibition.
There seems to be some interference. Can you please put your phone on mute, star 6?
Okay, and as you move back along the curve, you follow what's known as an imbibition curve, where the water is imbibed back into the pore space, and ultimately you can get back to the point that you have the NAPL held only by capillary action, and we'll be looking at that on the relative permeability slide in about 10 or 15 slides. The on the lower right-hand corner, we have the residual non-wetting phase saturation. And the amount of this residual non-wetting phase saturation is a function of how far along the drainage curve has gone. If you go only a short distance along that drainage curve and don't displace much water from the subsurface, you'll have a smaller residual non-wetting phase saturation than you would if you went further along that curve.
I might interject here that we don't talk much about the residual saturation in this basic training, and it is something which it is an area which is still somewhat under research. But my colleague Mark Adamski and Colin Johnston from CSIRO, who is part of the Australia National Laboratory, presented a paper last year in Costa Mesa at the API conference on residual saturation. It relates to residual saturation to how far up the drainage curve you initially move. Copies of that paper we can make available to you if you're interested in looking at this further. But in publications that are commonly referenced, residual saturations are quite high, but we haven't found that to be actually occur in practice. So it's an area that you might want to look into if you have to define residual saturations.
Thanks, Greg. Moving on to the next slide, slide 18. This is the Napple on a well and an adjacent formation. There's a lot of information on this slide, but a understanding of this figure can lead to a much better understanding of how Napple behaves in the subsurface. In the left-hand side of the figure, we have a monitoring well showing that the Napple is in the well. What is in the well represents what's in the continuous non-wetting Napple in the formation. The black triangle shows where the normal water table is. The red or pink and white triangle show where the Napple table is. The Napple extends below the Napple in the formation in the monitoring well. And the extension of the Napple in the well below the elevation of the formation increases as porous media become finer and the densities between the liquids become more similar. So one of the things that I look at in this figure here is an explanation of the paradox about why you can have a fair amount of Napple shown in a monitoring well, and yet it's not possible to pump out as much Napple as you might think. Moving on to the next panel, we show the Napple pressure as a straight line starting at the air-Napple interface at the top of the the wetted formation, going down to the point where it intersects with the water pressure line, which is at the point where the Napple formation in the well extends to. And the water pressure line follows a different slope because it's got a different density. And the slope of the line is rho GH, which creates your hydraulic head, the density of the material times the gravitational constant times the height of the the material, the liquid in the formation. The difference between the two curves is the between the water pressure curve extending horizontally to the Napple pressure curve, giving you your capillary pressure. Excuse me.
Let me interject here. The pressure indicates zero, but that's gauge pressure. What that pressure really is atmospheric pressure, or one atmosphere. So if you think about the Napple pressure line again, at the air-Napple interface, you have one atmosphere of pressure, and as you move into the saturated zone, the pressure is actually increasing because of the density of the Napple. We all know that density in the liquid phase is rho GH. So as you move below the air-Napple interface, which is at one atmosphere, the pressure is increasing. That's why the arrow is shown moving towards the right, and it's increasing at the rate of the density of the Napple times the thickness of the Napple. The same thing with the water pressure. At where the black triangle is at, that would be where the water pressure would be at one atmosphere, And as you move below that point, the pressure increases because of the density of water times the height. And where they meet is the bottom of El Napo in the well, or at the air, at the El Napo water interface.
Thanks, Vic. The third panel shows a diagram of the Napo saturation as a function of depth in the aquifer, and we'll be going over some figures similar to that in the next couple slides. And starting at the bottom of the Napo wetted portion of the formation, where the saturation is zero, it goes to a maximum on the right, but that maximum is less than 100% because the Napo can't displace all the water from the formation. And then the curve goes to the left where the air-Napo interface is reached, and you get into the capillary fringe for the Napo. So to me, these three panels here go a long way towards explaining why you have a fair amount of Napo in a well, and yet you can't recover as much as you might think from that well.
Another way to think about this graph is, it's an important graph because it relates the amount of Napo in a well to the amount of Napo that's going to be in the soil. And it's the middle panel indicates that it's strictly a function, in an equilibrium situation, it's strictly a function of hydrostatics, simple physics, and the difference between the two curves is the capillary pressure. And you saw a few slides previously that different soils have different capillary pressures. So the panel on the far right, the saturation that you're going to get is going to be different in different soils because of the capillary pressure. So there's if you just work through the hydrostatics and think about capillary pressure, you can see how the amount of Napo in a well is related to the amount of Napo that you're going to find in the soil.
Thanks, Vic. We're moving on to the next slide, slide 19, which is Napo saturation is a function of depth and Napo thickness. The lower curve is the Napo water capillary pressure curve, representing the saturation of water and Napo in a well, shown on the left. And that Napo water capillary pressure curve below the air-Napo interface allows you to determine the saturation of the water by reading on that curve and then subtracting that difference from 100%, or that number from 100% gives you the Napo saturation. Above the air-Napo interface, the distribution of air, Napo, and water in the vado zone is determined by the water-Napo capillary pressure curve. We should also note that Napo and water above this interface are virtually immobile. Moving on to the next slide, slide 20, measured equilibrium Napo saturations. The blue figure, or the blue line in this curve, was generated using information from the API database on Napo saturations in the subsurface, and the red triangles represent measured saturations. So you can see that you get a pretty good correlation between the measured saturations and those predicted using the database that we recommend to use for this work.
I'm sorry to correct you, Bob, but this figure actually came from published work by Dave Huntley in Groundwater in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
He and his graduate students worked at a number of service stations in San Diego and put together a couple of papers to relate, the Napo saturations that they found in the subsurface with predictions from the capillary pressure curves. And we'll be talking about this more under the case studies later on. So it's an early depiction of how to relate the amount of Napo in a well with capillary pressure and the saturations in the soil, and it's published in a peer-reviewed journal in Groundwater.
Okay. moving on to the next slide, slide 21, we show how grain size determines NAPL saturation distribution. So we've got three different media that we're looking at. From the left, we've got sandy silt to a silty sand to a sand. And we've got a 10-foot monitoring well thickness and a diesel fuel. So with the sand, which is a relatively coarse material, and as we discussed earlier, it's relatively easy for the NAPL to enter the subsurface, the maximum predicted saturation could be nearly 80%. Whereas for the much finer grain material, the maximum saturation is only about 7%. In practice, the actual saturations are much less than these shown on this on these theoretical curves, generally because the time for the equilibrium to be reached hasn't been met. In the next figure, we'll be looking at the intermediate figure for the silty sand, and we'll be looking at the effect of the amount of material in the monitoring well on the saturation. So that next figure is in slide number 22, the effect of thickness in the monitoring well on saturation in silty sand. So in the top line, the green line, we have a 10-foot monitoring well thickness, and the maximum saturation is about 35%. On the bottom figure, where there's a 1-foot thickness in there in the monitoring well, the maximum saturation is less than 5%. And this is one of the parameters that affects the ability to recover NAPL, and it explains why as more NAPL is pumped out of the subsurface, it becomes more difficult to recover. Okay, moving on to the next slide, slide 23. It's a depiction of estimating NAPL volumes. And we have a monitoring well depicted on the right side, and we have the capillary pressure prediction that we had mentioned a couple slides ago. And generally speaking, the capillary pressure prediction covers the extent that the monitoring well has NAPL in it. The pancake layer conceptualization that we've discussed earlier would only occupy a smaller fraction of the subsurface saturated zone, because there's an assumption of 100% saturation of the NAPL in that material. And as we looked in the previous slides, that 100% saturation isn't achieved, and a correction factor had to be applied to achieve the thickness that we thought would be met with the pancake layer conceptualization. If just the soil and water removed from a 1-square-foot cube, there would be a few inches of NAPL left in the cube. This is called the specific volume of NAPL in the soil, and is expressed in cubic foot per square foot, so often simplified to just feet. The specific volume of the NAPL would be the same as the volume you would calculate by integrating the capillary pressure distribution curve. Okay, moving on to the next slide, slide number 24. We've got specific volume versus monitoring well thickness for various media. And this graph illustrates how NAPL thickness in a monitoring or observation well is related to the actual thickness of fresh diesel and media of different grain sizes. The graph is important because it shows that the specific volume of NAPL in the subsurface is much less than the specific volume of NAPL measured in a monitoring well. This is because porous media contain a large amount of water in addition to NAPL. So if you look at the top figure, the blue figure for the sand, there's a much greater specific volume for the sand than there is for the silt, which is the green line at the bottom of the figure, and it's significantly greater.
I might comment here and check that, you know, various people that have worked with LNAPLs in the past would typically take, let's say, an observation well thickness, in this case maybe 2 feet, and divide it by some number. For gasoline, a lot of people use a value of 4, which is based upon a density ratio. So if you took 2 feet and divided it by 4, you get a formation thickness or a specific volume of 0.5. And it would be a straight line from 0 up to 0.5 where it would cross 2. And you can see here that depending upon the soil type, you're going to have a much different amount of LNAPL or thickness of LNAPL in the soil than you would have by just that simple relationship. So what this is kind of trying to show is that for different soil types, this kind of equivalent thickness or the specific volume that you have in the soil is highly dependent upon the soil, and it's also going to be dependent upon the type of fuel that you have.
Okay, moving on to our next slide, slide 25, assumptions for the saturation prediction. NAPL saturation predictions are typically based on a set of assumptions. These include fluids are at vertical equilibrium, which I just mentioned. The water table is stationary. A single capillary pressure curve is used, and the media are homogeneous. The next two slides discuss NAPL thickness in wells as a function of water table elevation and also as a function of time. If you look at the top figure or top line in this figure, at least on the left-hand side, it shows the water table elevation plotted over a 7-year period from 1991 to 1998. The red line is the NAPL thickness in the monitoring well, which appears to show an inverse relationship to the water table elevation. When the water table goes up, the NAPL thickness goes down, and vice versa. On the next slide, there's an animation attached to this slide, and it's not part of our presentation today. You can go to our website and see this animation. And it shows how this plume, which was a result of a one-time spill, apparently increased and decreased in size with time. And it's important in that curve to look at the ground level elevation on the right-hand side and the thickness of the plume on the left-hand side. Vic has referred to a couple of different articles from groundwater, and one of those articles, published in 1996, was used in this book, Contaminant Hydrology, by Fetter. And I just wanted to read from that for their 4 different explanations that give you an idea of what we're dealing with here. The first situation is the monitoring wells have no floating NAPL, even though there is considerable hydrocarbon in the adjacent soil. This may occur due to entrapped hydrocarbons both above and below the water table due to the fluctuations of the water table. The second situation is that the thickness of the floating NAPL in the monitoring well decreases when the water table rises. That's what we mentioned in the slide previous to this one. Oil will be trapped in the soil as the water table rises, and hence there is less mobile oil able to enter the well. The third situation, and this is particularly evident in the animation associated with this slide, NAPL may suddenly appear or disappear in monitoring wells across the site. A sudden increase in the water table may completely trap the hydrocarbon and result in a complete disappearance of floating NAPL in the monitoring wells. There's a minimal amount of mobile oil that must be present before any NAPL will accumulate in the monitoring well. Think of what I was talking about earlier in terms of the minimum water saturation or the minimum NAPL saturation that has to be reached before either of those fluids will be reached. When the minimum amount is exceeded, NAPL will suddenly appear in the well. The fourth situation is if the water table drops to the point where it is lower than any previous time, the floating NAPL may disappear. This may be due to the fact that the hydrocarbons may slowly move through the soil, low conductivity, that is, and does not drop at the same rate as the water table. Hence, the system is out of equilibrium, and the mobile oil has simply not had enough time to reach a new equilibrium and enter the well. what I'm trying to illustrate by these four examples here is that oftentimes a simple measurement of how much naphthalene in the well might not be the complete picture of what you have to understand it, and you have to have several data points across various seasons to be able to reach this kind of understanding that you should have.
I'll interject here too that, you know, quite a few people, when they look at, you know, the basic theory that we're talking about here, worry that, you know, it makes it extremely, that we can't make good quantitative predictions of the amount of L-NAPL that's in place or its recovery. And part of the point of the field case studies that I'm going to be discussing later on is to show you that even though we have these kinds of non-equilibrium situations and heterogeneous soils, we can still go a long way towards making quantitative predictions of how much NAPL is there and how well it can be recovered.
Thanks, Greg. Okay, moving on to slide 28, comparison of NAPL volumes, capillary pressure prediction versus pancake conceptualization. On the right-hand side, we have a pancake conceptualization for the amount of NAPL volume in a one square foot area with an apparent well thickness of 3 feet, and that would be nearly 8 gallons. Using the capillary pressure predictions for from moving from left to right, coarse sand, fine sand, and silt, there is much less NAPL volume that is predicted to be in the subsurface, ranging from 4.3 gallons for the coarse sand all the way down to a negligible amount for the silt. So it's important to understand what medium the NAPL is present in to be able to get a good idea of the NAPL volume in the subsurface. Okay, slide 29. Is the NAPL really distributed where we think? If we know the geology, have measured the porous media and fluid data, and understand the history of the site, it is likely that we understand the distribution of NAPL. There's a variety of factors that limits our ability to understand NAPL distribution and to estimate its volume of the subsurface. Geology may vary, and that's what Vic was just mentioning, that you have a heterogeneous situation in the subsurface. Fluids may not be in vertical equilibrium, and NAPL saturation measurements may be incorrect. Okay, moving on to the next slide, slide 30. What volume of NAPL is hydraulically recoverable? NAPL is hydraulically recoverable when the rate of recovery using conventional hydraulic methods, pumping and skimming, is technically feasible and greater than the point of diminishing returns at the site. Factors affecting hydraulic recovery include the residual saturation trapped by the capillary forces, the heterogeneity of the soil, and the conductivity of the NAPL phase. Next slide, relative permeability, slide number 31. Relative permeability is one of the most important parameters affecting the flow of NAPL in porous media. NAPL flows in the larger pores, water flows in the smaller pores. And think back to the microphotograph that I showed at the beginning of the presentation where the water was in the smaller pore spaces and the NAPL in the larger ones. The ability to flow is an average over the pore sizes and the volume through which the fluid is flowing. The ability of the porous media to allow flow of a fluid when other fluid phases are present relative to its ability to allow flow for that fluid when no other fluid phases are present is called its relative permeability. The relative permeability of a fluid depends on its saturation and the saturation of other fluids present. Relative permeability is fluid specific and ranges from 0 to 1. Next slide, slide 32. Shows the conceptual relative phase permeability function. It introduces or reintroduces a couple concepts we had from other slides. If you look at the x-axis, you've got water saturation plotted from 0 to 100%, and the inverse of that in the saturated zone is the NAPL saturation from 100% to 0%. And although we're looking at two different fluids here, there are similarities between the two. For example, when the NAPL saturation is 100%, its relative permeability is 1, just as the water saturation has a relative permeability of 1 when its saturation is 100%. You have an irreducible water saturation for the water where it's held in place by capillary action, and you also have a residual NAPL saturation where the NAPL is held in place by capillary action. The water and the NAPL are competing with one another for pore space and for ability to flow, and this is illustrated most extremely when you look at the intersection of the two curves where the total of the water relative permeability and the NAPL permeability is less than 1, whereas it would be 1 if it was pure phase for either one of these phases. Okay, the next slide, the conductivity of NAPL. This is Darcy's equation where the flow is proportional to the conductivity times the gradient. The gradient is equal to the permeability of the porous media, and that's a function of whether it's a sand or a silt or a clay, multiplied by the NAPL density, multiplied by the gravitational constant, then divided by the NAPL viscosity. For multi-phase flow, where water and NAPL are present in the subsurface, the relative permeability is also included in the conductivity equation. The NAPL conductivity can also be calculated from the conductivity of water, since the viscosity and density of water both have a value of about 1. Multiply the conductivity of water by the density of NAPL at the field temperature, and then divide by the viscosity of the NAPL. Note that NAPL conductivity is inversely proportional to its viscosity. So the conductivity of a fuel oil with the viscosity be about 6 times of water would be 6 times less than the conductivity of gasoline, which has a viscosity slightly less than water. The next slide, slide number 34, shows NAPL conductivities in different porous media. On the x-axis, we've got monitoring well thickness plotted, and on the y-axis, we've got the conductivity plotted in centimeters per second. And you can see that the sand has always got a greater conductivity than the silty sand or the sandy silt for the same monitoring well thickness. You can also notice that once roughly 3 feet of monitoring well thickness has been reached, that these curves seem to plateau out. But on the other hand, as there's less monitoring well thickness in NAPL present, the conductivity goes down. And we saw that a couple slides ago where we looked at the effect of monitoring well thickness on on saturation in the soil. So this also is another example of where it gives us some understanding about why, as more NAPL is removed from the subsurface, it becomes progressively more difficult to recover. The next slide, slide 39, shows the effect of viscosity and density on the conductivity of different NAPLs. We've got gasoline, diesel, and oil plotted. Gasoline, which has got a much lower viscosity than oil, has got a greater conductivity, despite the fact that the oil has got a greater density than the gasoline.
You know, relative permeability is an extremely difficult concept to grasp. You've got in these soils you have a lot of different pore sizes with pore throats. And you have water and oil which are trying to compete to move through that pore space under a given pressure drop. And how many pores they actually fill has a big impact upon how well the fluids can a given fluid can flow through that porous media. So as you have more filled with water from the smaller pores on up towards larger pores, and then you have only some of the larger pores filled with L-NAPL, you have a relatively greater permeability to, let's say, water than you have to L-NAPL. But if you go the other way and start to fill more of the pores with L-NAPL from the larger pores down to the smaller pores and decrease the amount of water, then the relative permeability or the relative ability of the L-NAPL to flow is greater than water. So you generate these relative permeability curves, which is a kind of a relative ability of the different L-NAPLs and waters to flow. And so as you move up and down in saturation with these fluids, its ability to flow increases or decreases. And in these situations where we start to produce a lot of the L-NAPL out of the soil, there's less and less pores which are filled with L-NAPL, so it becomes their ability to flow decreases, more than proportionally, but it decreases significantly and becomes more and more difficult to recover L-NAPL. It's a difficult concept that takes reservoir engineers quite a bit of time to understand, the production of oil from petroleum reservoirs, and it's in many ways the same kind of thing that happens to us in superficial aquifers.
Yeah, I can relate to what Vic just said. I mean, even though I've worked in technical areas for the last 20 years in these concepts, reading this material and understanding it, it's only been on many readings and re-readings and also reading some of the references that Vic has referred to that I've been able to get what I think is a pretty good understanding of this. So these are pretty difficult concepts and require a fair amount of reflection to really understand.
I will say that we've tried to, Randy Charbonneau from the University of Texas has been putting together spreadsheets for API, which are available off the API L-NAPL website. We can go in now and we can calculate a lot of these things using spreadsheets and come up with some reasonable predictions. Understanding the theory behind that is fairly difficult, but you could take some of these concepts and begin to quantify them using the spreadsheets.
Okay, I'm going to skip the next two slides in the interest of time, and they describe bail down tests and how they're used to evaluate NAPL conductivity. You can read those in the notes for the presentation. There's a lot of good notes we have for all these slides. So we're going to move on to slide number 38, which is NAPL migration. Now that we've discussed NAPL conductivity, we can begin to look at the migration of the NAPL phase. NAPL migration is affected by several factors, including its conductivity, which is related to the first three sub-bullets there, the groundwater hydraulic gradient through Darcy's law, which we discussed earlier, and the pore throat displacement entry pressure and a fluctuating water table. As we have just seen, NAPL conductivity depends on its fluid properties, its relative permeability, and the conductivity of the porous media. How poor float displacement entry pressure and a fluctuating water table may affect NAPL migration may be less well understood. Recall from the capillary pressure curves that a certain pressure needs to be applied to the NAPL port to move through the pore throat. This is called the displacement entry pressure. If the upgradient pressure is not sufficient at the leading edge of the plume to force the NAPL through the pore throats in the media, the NAPL cannot migrate. So if you think about it, if there's not enough hydraulic head, the NAPL can't overcome these pore pressures and will stay where it is until there is enough hydraulic head to do that. In a clean, coarse sand, the displacement entry pressure is lower and the plume can spread more easily. In a very fine grain media, the displacement entry pressure can be quite high and effectively prevents the NAPL from migrating. A fluctuating water table can prevent the NAPL from migrating because as the water table rises, the NAPL can become trapped as residual. I mentioned that earlier in the examples. This effect will be illustrated shortly. At many sites where releases have been stopped, these factors combine to produce a plume that is neither spreading nor migrating. Okay, moving on to the next slide, we've got a short example here before the examples that Vic gets into later on. In this example, a numerical model is used to predict the potential migration of an apple plume. The soil has a sand with a high conductivity of 46 feet per day. The hydraulic conductivity is about a thousandth of a foot per foot, so we would expect that groundwater would move about 35 feet per year, assuming a porosity of about 0.5. This is not a very high velocity. The NAPL is a heating oil with a density of 0.9 and a viscosity about 20 times that of water. You can see the plume slot size on the next slide. And this plume size, I believe, is related to the photograph that we showed earlier that had the animation associated with it. In the upper left-hand corner is the original release area. In the upper right is the release after a year, and the lower left is the release after 5 years, and the bottom right is the release after 56 years. So much of the migration for that one-time spill occurred in the first year, and in the subsequent 56 years, there's not too much migration. The next slide, slide 50, shows the spatial distribution of the NAPL conductivity. The far outside ring shows a conductivity of zero, and the middle ring shows a conductivity of 0.5. Note that there's NAPL conductivity in the center where the NAPL saturation is greater and is greater than the residual saturation. However, no conductivity is apparent at the edge where NAPL saturation is less than or equal to residual saturation. Thus, a well at the center of the plume would be more likely to contain NAPL that is recoverable than a well near the edge of the plume. Next slide, slide 42. Our results are that the NAPL plume has the potential to migrate and is partially recoverable in the central portion of the plume. The general groundwater gradient of 0.001 is not sufficient to cause the plume migration. Containment of the NAPL is not a concern at the site, and we should focus our recovery efforts in the conductive portion of the plume. The next slide, slide 43, discusses NAPL migration and recovery. The spreading of NAPL plumes can be predicted using numerical models, and there's three of them that we mentioned in our notes section. One of them, the hydrocarbon spill screening model, depends on the head pressure in the NAPL due to the conductivity of the NAPL in the vadose zone, the thickness of the water table, and the conductivity of the NAPL. At the edges of the spreading NAPL, it also depends upon the displacement head pressure, which affects the NAPL's ability to enter a pore. We can also use simple analytical models or more complicated numerical ones to make recovery predictions, which we will discuss next. The analytical models are based on the same assumptions and concepts as the HSSM, but incorporate them into spreadsheets for general use. All of these models deal with liquid flow. Only a few include vapor or airflow, such as you would see in some recovery methods, and they have some limitations and instabilities when the simultaneous movement of air, NAPL, and water is simulated. Moving on to the next slide, slide 44, objectives of recovery predictions. The objectives of recovery predictions are to design efficient free product recovery systems using trenches, skimmer wells, and single and dual pump wells, provide estimates of recovery performance, provide estimates of recovery time, and provide means of establishing practical endpoints.
So this is really quantitatively where we want to go. When we formed the LNAPL Cleanup Alliance in 2001, as Ellen said, the real concern was that we were working on a lot of RCRA projects, that there wasn't any advances being made in terms of the LNAPL on the site. And so we wanted to develop LNAPL management plans for how the LNAPL was going to be recovered, at what rate, when are we going to reach endpoints? What are we going to do about the remainder of the LNAPL that's there? And in order to make those kinds of judgments, we need some ways to predict how much LNAPL we're starting with, what rate at which we can recover it, what is going to be the time of recovery, and what is going to be the endpoint. How do we define maximum extent practical? So a lot of the material that we're talking about today in terms of the capillary pressure and the relative permeability affect the amount of LNAPL that we have originally in the soil and the rate at which we can obtain it. So, you know, in many ways, this is a key slide, or at least, you know, a key to what we're trying to do with this training and where we're trying to go with it.
Okay. We're on slide 45, conceptual recovery model, and we'll be discussing these concepts in the next couple slides. This simple picture is used to show the important parameters that affect recovery. While the analytical models seem to revert to a pancake model type at first glance, this is just for illustrative purposes. The parameters include the radius of capture, R sub C, or the radius of NAPL that can flow into the well, and the extraction rates for water, Q sub W, and oil, Q sub O, from the well. As we know from the previous discussion of conductivity, the relative permeability and saturation are important. Finally, the monitoring well thickness and the thickness of the saturated zone are also needed. What is not shown explicitly in the figure is the residual saturation in the vadose and saturated zones, and we'll talk about that in the next slide, which is slide 46. In the recovery models, the residual saturations in the vadose and saturated zones are added to the distribution calculated using the capillary pressure curves, the fluid properties, and the monitoring well thickness. Our next slide is slide 47, approximate distribution for hydraulic recovery model. On two slides previous, we used a pancake figure for illustrative purposes. For actual recovery predictions, the distribution of the NAPL is approximated by a series of pancakes or differential elements. Shortly, we will see how this is related to the capillary pressure and the NAPL distribution. And there are two of these differential elements that are shown in this figure here. One is a larger one, the second one is a smaller one, that approximately, but not perfectly, cover what is shown on the saturation curve. Vic, you probably know this much better than I, but how many of these differential elements would be used in a typical modeling exercise?
In Randy Charbonneau's models, he uses three.
Mm-hmm.
A complex numerical model would use, you know, it could go all along the green curves. But in order to get this to be done on your desktop with simple spreadsheets, Randy's approximated that green curve with three different pancakes, so to speak, and that allows it to be done on with Excel spreadsheets on your desktop.
Thanks, Vic. We're on to slide 48, prediction of free product pumping or free product recovery with water pumping. This is a pretty complex equation that's used in these Randy Charbonneau spreadsheets, but simply stated, shows that the oil recovery is a function of the water recovery and inversely proportional to the viscosity. So the NAPL recovery is determined by the water drawdown, and NAPL recovery is Q sub O. Water drawdown is determined by water production, and there's a weak dependence on aquifer hydraulic recovery. From this relatively simple equation, it is easy to see the expected effects of various parameters on NAPL recovery. For example, the viscosity of the NAPL occurs in the denominator and is inversely proportional to the NAPL recovery rate. In other words, if the NAPL viscosity increased by a factor of 3, we would expect the NAPL recovery rate to be reduced by a factor of 3, and the time required to recover an equivalent amount would be increased by a factor of 3.
5 years ago, I would never really ask a consultant to measure the viscosity of LNAPL in the soil, and now it's one of the first parameters that we go out there to measure, because you can see through this equation that just by increasing the viscosity, the rate, the time it's going to take to recover the LNAPL goes up proportionately. But we took out a slide also that shows you the effect of alpha and beta and where those come from, they're related to the capillary pressure curves. And so if you have soils with different capillary pressure curves, you'll have different alphas and betas, and that affects, that's how the soil comes into this equation.
Okay, we're on slide 49, NAPL recovery rate. This slide plots the NAPL recovery for a fresh diesel and sandy soil versus monitoring well thickness for various water extraction rates. As the water extraction rate increases, the NAPL recovery rate also increases. This follows from the expression from the NAPL recovery given in the previous slide.
What's that stated here is that, you know, using these kinds of predictions, then you can begin to understand what it's going to take in terms of your water recovery rates, pumping rates to recover LNAPL. You know, increased recovery rates, water rates, you have increased water treatment costs, closer spacing of wells, increased. So you can begin to understand what it's going to take to recover a given amount of LNAPL under different scenarios, and so you can do your cost-benefit analysis. Go through those kinds of thinking to begin to design your recovery systems or begin to look at recovery systems and what is practical and what is not practical.
Okay, slide 50, NAPL recovery limitations. Predicting NAPL recovery has several limitations. The models assume ideal wells, spacing, and homogeneity, all of which add artificial optimism. Generally, we would expect recoveries, we would expect predictions to overestimate the volume and rate of recovery. On the other hand, they generally underestimate the time required to remove the NAPL. Predicted NAPL saturations, conductivities, and recoverability should be compared to field measurements whenever practicable. This will allow confidence in the predictions. Some of this will be illustrated in the five real-world case studies, which Vic will discuss at the end of the presentation. We're running slightly ahead of our time, about 10 minutes ahead, and we had anticipated a 15-minute question and answer period.
That's okay. We'll still do questions and answers.
Yeah. So I think we can handle 10 or 15 minutes, Ellen.
Yeah, we're good. Thanks, Bob and Vic, for that. And we're going to break for questions now. So I'm going to open up the line for any questions. I have a bunch of questions that were written into me. And if you have any other questions, please write them down on your question mark icon and submit them. But if there's anybody on the line who has a question, please unmute your phone and identify yourself and where you're from and ask your question. Okay, why don't
This is Beth Rowan with R&T. And I have a question about the reduced density and reduced viscosity that you show on slide 48.
Okay.
Is that just representing them, it's relative to the LNAPL relative to water? Is that essentially
correct.
What they're doing?
Yeah.
Okay.
I recall that from my old transport phenomena days.
Yeah, so the density and viscosity of water are both one, so actually we could put it there, the density of the LNAPL and the density and the viscosity of the LNAPL.
Okay.
Any other questions on the phone line?
My name is Elisa Hike. I have just a generic question. Talking about the viscosity of LNAPL, are there any studies to show how it changes with time? And the next thing is, are there any studies to show any result comparison of bell down test versus pump test for LNAPL? And also, are there any studies to show any changes of interfacial tension with time?
I can address part of your question. I'll let Vic handle the other hand or the other part of it. One of the things that we emphasize in the longer version of the course is that the NAPL changes as it's weathered. And Vic mentioned earlier the importance of collecting viscosity measurements from the LNAPL on site. Also in our live presentations, we talk about the importance of other parameters such as particle size distribution. So the weathering of the napple does change its properties. It probably, with the light ends evaporating and most likely the lighter ends biodegrading, you have a heavier product, which means a greater density and a greater viscosity. Dick?
I guess, Lily, I'd have to refer you to, you know, the chemical engineering text on how viscosity varies over time. Viscosity and density vary over time. You can take equations of state and given the compositions, calculate up densities, and from that you can calculate up viscosities. I know in the oil business, you know that's fairly important when you're producing oil from some of these reservoirs, because the light ends are produced first, and then the density viscosities of what's left increase with time. So there's been an awful lot of work that has been done on that. And, you know, if you went to a sophisticated numerical simulator, you could probably do that. You also probably need to be, you also have to be aware, as I'll mention later, that these fluids change with aquifer temperature, so you want to make sure the measurements are done near the aquifer temperature. As far as interfacial tensions are concerned, you know, again, these will change with time. I don't think we've looked at them in a long enough time frame to be able to say at what rate the you know, interfacial tensions change with time. I'll mention now, and so I won't have to mention later, that if you look at in the literature, a lot of your interfacial properties, the references are talking about experiments that have been done with L-Napple, which is right out of the pump, let's say, or right out of the can, right out of the tank, versus water, which is relatively pure. And when you get into these situations where the L-Napple has been in contact with groundwater for a long period of time and geochemistry changes have taken place because of biological activity, the interfacial tensions have changed. Those situations are relatively stable, in my way of thinking, you know, over a period of decades, once the biological activity has taken place or continues to occur. So I would expect that after a relatively, short period of time, a year or 2 years, you'll probably develop kind of an equilibrium situation that'll, you know, be there for quite a long period of time, unless we've gone through some kind of maybe an SVE operation where we're pulling away the light ends, adding oxygen, taking away oxygen, altering the, let's say, the methanogenic or the anaerobic situations that occurring. If that occurs over a relatively short period of time, then you might see some kind of a change. But we haven't done enough studies to measure for me to give you a definitive quantitative answer on that.
Okay, let's go to a couple questions.
I have one more question about bail down and pump test results.
Oh.
Anybody done any studies bail
down? Again, David Huntley has published a recent paper, 2000 in groundwater. Don Lundy are probably the only two people that I know that have published some work. Don made a presentation last year in Costa Mesa on bail down tests. Tom Fail has been doing some work at Colorado State, and you might contact Tom or API. I don't know what can be released on that, but Tom's been doing some work, and I'll plug his work because it really looks fairly interesting, in that regard. So I'd say contact Tom Sale or API for the recent work that he's been doing.
Okay, thanks, Vic. Let's go to the computer, and we have a question from Dave Corder from QED Environmental Systems. He wanted to know if there's any suggested special well development approaches for product-only recovery wells. Here's a bunch of questions that are all related, so let me ask them all at once. Are there any suggested filter pack or screen material sizes, such as wire wraps, et cetera, for increasing effectiveness of product-only recovery? And which pump cycling approach seems to be the more appropriate, effective for product-only recovery, zero accumulation, pulse cycling, methodical removal by gradually removing the upper one-third of well product volume? And then the last question is, what are considered to be the most effective product-only removal enhancements? Vacuum, dual pump, drawdown, steam, co-solvent flushing, etc.
Okay.
That's a lot.
Well, as far as well wrap, I wouldn't have thought there was much of a difference. There was some recent work, again, that I'll point you to, Tom Fail, in his recent studies about LNAPL conductivity and measurement techniques, who saw some, I'll characterize them as minor impacts of different well wraps. You know, maybe you wouldn't consider, maybe people wouldn't consider a minor, but I think over the long run, they probably wouldn't make much of a difference. But again, I'll have to refer you to Tom Fail and some unpublished work that he's been doing for wire wraps. As far as pumping configurations, pulsing and all of that, I'd say the thing we found to be the most effective, and again, we probably could have a long discussion on this, is to keep the water table at a constant elevation so LNAPL continues to flow in a well. I think as we look at it, fluctuating water tables where you've got saturation changes that are occurring and LNAPL moving up and down you know, in the well and in the soil is detrimental to LNAPL recovery. It's better to keep a constant elevation and keep it going constant. As far as the type of recovery is concerned, that's part of the point of or a major point of what we're trying to do with some of this quantitative predictions. If you go to the spreadsheets that Randy Charbonneau developed, you can test quantitatively different types of LNAPL recovery. And, you know, as you might expect, if you had significant water pumping under vacuum, you could probably have your biggest hydraulic recovery rates. But those require significant cost of capital. You might have significant air treatment costs, significant water treatment costs, and in the long run, they may not be the most cost-effective method. So, you know, what you're able to do with the understanding here and the spreadsheets have been developed is to go through a quantitative evaluation of different pumping schemes, different methods of recovery to try to come up with the best situation for the site, the best management plan for the site in terms of LNAPL recovery. Hope that answers at least partially the question. I don't know that any, you know, a lot of those are debatable.
Thanks, Greg. Let's open up the phone line one more time for any last-minute questions on the phone.
Can I ask another question since nobody's asking?
Sure.
Anybody did any studies to find out how quickly equilibrium is reached?
I'll refer you to Kambalski. Kambalski and Chang in 1989, their paper is probably the only thing in the literature that I'm aware of that deals with vertical equilibrium. Randy Charbonneau and his students at University of Texas have done some work. It's been presented to you know, a group of us from API, but I don't know that work has been ever published. So I'd have to refer you to Randy Charbonneau, you know, to see about that. It's a difficult situation because it'll be highly dependent upon, you know, the particular soil type you have and the layering that you have.
Okay, thanks, Vic. Let's answer a couple more questions from online. Bennett from URS wanted to know what the reference for an equation on slide 48 is. The reference for the equation on slide 48.
There's Randy Charbonneau has published some material. I think it's in Groundwater over the years. But if you go to api.org/LNAPL, you can download the reference, the backup for the software And in those, in that reference material there, you'll be able to get these references for the published papers. So, and that's a free download from api.org/lnapples. It's probably also in the RTDF website somewhere, but I can't point to you specifically where to get it.
Okay, thanks, Dick. Why don't we continue on if you want to start with the case studies?
Okay.
And we'll answer the rest. I've gotten a lot more questions, but we'll answer the rest at the end.
Okay. All right, well, I'm going to take you through two separate sections. One is the field work, you know, how to collect core and information, what information to collect from the field, and the other one is the case studies. So slide 52 is we're going to begin with LNAPL assessment, obtaining core samples, preserving core samples, laboratory measurements, and then laser-induced fluorescence. I don't know how many people are familiar with that technique. But to obtain core samples, the preferred situation is to have an existing well which contains LNAPL that has been cored. So we have some idea of the geology and depth of the likely LNAPL occurrence. You know, my colleagues and I, we go back and forth on this a little bit, but typically what we like to do is we like to put in one boring in which we determine a lot of very detailed information. We want to determine the percent gravel, sand, and fines in the particular soil. We want to look at water content of the soil. We want to look at odor. We want to look at soil structure, signs of LNAPL. We got to get some PID and FID readings. And then we want to go probably about 5 feet below the deepest LNAPL penetration that we think we have. In other words, we want to go very deep below the water table. You saw from Bob's presentation that LNAPL actually is below the potentiometric surface, so we have to core below the water table. To get this information, we're going to spend about $5,000 looking at two soil borings, one to collect the information on the screen in front of you, and one then to collect some capillary pressure data and LNAPL saturation data. And because we're spending that amount of money, we typically want to have a good geologist out in the field who's going to develop a boring log with the information that you see in front of you, which is going to be used later on in our modeling studies with collecting some additional data. So if you go to the next slide, slide 53 or 54, we collect then a second core based upon the first one that we're going to preserve. And this second core, you know, there's some different ways you can collect it, but typically it's collected in a core holder, a sampler of some sort, typically like a Shelby tube. If it's in those tubes, when it's pulled from the soil, it's you fill any space with plastic wrap, seal it with Teflon fill, and tape on plastic ends. If they're not in the core, if they're not in sleeves, you gently slide it from the sampler, you know, support it, wrap it in plastic, and secure it with clear tape. But what we really want is we want undisturbed core samples. You label it all. You sequentially label it so you know at what depth it's taken from. You immediately pack it in dry ice, typically, or freeze it with liquid nitrogen. Now, there was a lot of apprehension when we first started to do this that freezing these cores in liquid nitrogen is going to destroy the soil structure, but we have not found that to be a fact. And then these cores are stored typically at the laboratory that we send them in for analysis for a long period of time, so we go back to them over a period of time to maybe perform additional tests. And we ship these cores to the laboratory overnight. When the laboratory gets the cores, what we ask them to do is typically to slab the cores and then to photograph them in normal light and in ultraviolet light. Hydrocarbon that has double bonds in it fluoresces, and under the UV light then we can see where the LNAPL is at. We then perform saturation analysis where we have LNAPL. And you will see some pictures later on of cores under both natural and UV light. And we look at it under these two different kinds of lights, the photographs, and then we also look at the detail boring log we have, and we pick out places in which we do grain size analysis. I'm on slide 56 now, and a few Attenberg limits. We'll pick out a few places where we want to do one or more air water or El Napo water drainage capillary pressure curves, and we'll also pick out those areas where we want to measure the saturation, the amount of El Napo which is in the soil under different places. Because what we want to do is we want to use the models then to relate the capillary pressure measurements that we're doing with the actual saturation measurements that we have in the core. So we have this we have this data that we're relating to model predictions to hopefully calibrate or help us calibrate our thinking about how much El Napo is there and our ability to predict it. Some of our consultants like to get not only the drainage capillary pressure curve but also the imbibition capillary pressure curve, and they want to measure relative permeability curves. Measurement of El Napo of relative permeability curves is extremely difficult and costly. A set of El Napo of relative permeability curves will probably run you at a minimum of about $5,000, and if you have tight soils like clay, it's going to be very, very difficult to get meaningful data. So typically we use models for relative permeability, and I typically just use a drainage capillary pressure curve, although there are some consultants that use imbibition. So moving on to the next slide, which is slide 57, fluid property testing. I already mentioned that fluid properties, what you get out of a can or out of the pump, and you combine it with water, tap water, is very different from what you get out of the field. So what we ask our consultants to do is to collect El Napo and groundwater samples from a nearby well, ship those to the laboratory, cold, for measurement of fluid properties as soon as possible. We ask them to measure density, viscosity, interfacial and surface tensions, at about the temperature of the aquifer for our use later on in the model. Laser fluid induced fluorescence. This is a technique that, going back a few years ago, I really had a hard time understanding what I was going to do with this technique, but in recent years it's proved to be quite useful. LIF is a technique, it's sometimes called ROOST or SCAPS. It was developed by the Air Force and the Navy to determine where El Napo occurs in the soil. If a hydrocarbon has double bonds or is polyaromatic, it fluoresces when it's in the Napo phase. And these tools send out a UV light to create a fluorescence which is then bounces back to the tool, which is then measured by the tool, and it can tell you where the El Napo is at in the soil. At some sites, you can successfully develop a correlation between the amount of fluorescence that's induced and the saturation, but at other sites we've had a very difficult time developing those types of correlations. The next figure 59, shows you a CPT LIF result for a given site. LIF is oftentimes bundled with a cone penetrometer. The cone penetrometer is there's ASTM techniques for cone penetrometers, and depending upon the tangential and normal stresses that occur on this tool, you can tell what type of soil it has. So on the far left hand side here, you see the cone penetrometer with depth. And you can see where you have a silt, where you have a sand. To the left-hand side, those are different symbols for where you would have a silt and sand occurring with depth. The middle panel shows you the fluorescence response with depth. And what you see here is that in this particular case, it was a gasoline spill, and the gasoline occurs in the sandy structures at about 12 feet, and again, at about 18 to 20 feet. If you remember with the capillary pressure relationships, the El Napo was able to displace the water in the sand, so it moved into the sand structure where you have that little lens of tight soil at about 17 feet or so. There's no LNAPL, and then the LNAPL occurs again in the deeper sand formation. The waveforms on the right are what you get from the Ross instrument. They're waveforms which would be typical of different LNAPL types, which would occur in the soil. In this case, they're typical of gasoline, although the bottom one looks to be a little bit different than typical gasoline. This next figure, figure 60, shows you some cores from a site which is near the southern end of Lake Michigan in northwest Indiana. The figures on the left-hand side are natural light, and the figures in that are kind of yellowish are in UV light. If it's darker in UV light, then there means there's no fluorescence, and, you know, most oils have some compounds that fluoresce, but you might find an oil that has nothing that, no compounds that fluoresce, in which case it would be dark. But typically you'll see some fluorescence, which will be an indication of LNAPL. You can see this core was said to be, from the boring logs, to be a uniform medium sand. You can see in the figures on the left that below 9 feet there's a lot of gravel structure that occurs in the soil, and certainly there's a lot of, there looks to be LNAPL there. Below 13 feet it's a much more uniform sand. It looks to be a little darker in terms of fluorescence, but there's no calibration between the fluorescent figures, so it's hard to tell from this whether there's less NAPL at 13 feet than there is at 9 feet, but there is LNAPL there also at 13 feet. This next figure, figure 61, is for a clay with fractures. You'll see some figures later on when we talk about the case studies, or at least one figure later on about a clay with macro pores. In this case, you have the clay structure has been injected with a material which has been dyed black, so you can see the fractures type of material which was occurred in the clay. What you find is that with these clay structures is that the LNAPL occurs in these fractured materials, and in the matrices, which in this case is kind of blue, they'll be primarily water. This is another depiction of a core from a Texas sand. This was a ruptured benzene pipeline site. In the figure on the left, which is the under UV light, you've got 27% fines in kind of a lighter material, and 27% or 47% fines in a more gray material. If you look at the figure on the right, which is in under UV light, at 27% fines, we've got about 15% benzene. This is all below the saturated zone, so where you have less fines, it holds water less tightly, so you get the benzene moving into that area in preference to where you have a greater amount of fines and the water is held more tightly. These are the kinds of situations that we're trying to deal with in terms of expectations of LNAPL recovery, where we have this distribution of hydrocarbon in the core material in the soil. So theory versus reality, the major issues at real sites. We have to deal with heterogeneity, with fluctuating water table. We want to collect site data because what we want to do is we have difficult heterogeneous situations and fluctuating water table situations. So what we'd like to have is we'd like to have good site data, so when we run our models, we can go back and forth between the site data and the models and make sure that we're getting adequate predictions for the volume and the recovery rates of our fluids. We want to be able to collect, there is a difficulty in terms of collecting site-specific data, as we've already seen with some situations that we'll see further in the next few slides. And I mentioned to you that the cost, at record sites where we're spending a lot of money, perhaps the cost is not a major cost, but at service station sites or those types of sites, you're talking about a significant percentage of the total cost of the project to be able to collect some of this information. So we're moving on to case studies. And these are using field data and good judgment to make some predictions of what's happening. We're going to talk about five different case studies. We're first going to look at a case where we're calculating LNAP volume in heterogeneous media. This is from the papers that I mentioned of Dave Huntley in 94. We're then going to look at predicting recovery rates in medium sands. This is with a fluctuating water table and a somewhat heterogeneous situation. We're going to look at practical limits of recovery in the clay. We're going to look at how an LNAP management plan for a closed refinery was formulated. And then we're going to look at plume genesis and mobility, how a plume spread out from a pipeline spill and how it distributed itself in the subsurface. So if you had looked at online at the RTDF training, you'd have seen the figure before on the right-hand side. Keep having a look at my right hand to tell you what side of the figure I'm looking at. We're on slide 65, by the way. This is from Dave Huntley and his graduate students. They went to a service station in San Diego, and they cored down through the soil below the water table. And they had, in a few of these instances, a layering, geologic layering. And what you see on the in this figure is the black dots are their measured saturation. So they took soil, from the soil cores that they took core plugs and measured the actual saturation in those core plugs. For each of the different soil types that they saw, they actually did a separate capillary pressure measurement. And what you see on the figure on the right is, you see for, as they move below the water table, with the different capillary pressures with depth and the different soil types with depth, they would predict a different amount of LNAP saturation, which is the x-axis in the soil. So they've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. They've got about 8 different soil types, so they've predicted about 8 different amounts of LNAP with the soil. You can see that in some of the cases, it's a rather good prediction. In some cases, you'd say, well, they're predicting zero LNAP saturation, hydrocarbon saturation, whereas the model's predicting a greater amount. And we're going to see if we can predict here the amount of LNAP that would be measured underneath the black dots versus the prediction on the next slide. The slide on the left, if you took all the different capillary pressure curves and for the given thickness of LNAP in a well, you'd have all these different amounts of all these different saturation distributions that would be predicted if you had assumed a homogeneous media, and each one of those would predict a different amount of LNAP in the soil. So if we go to the next slide, this is a table which outlines their results. You've got 4 different boreholes, and you've got 4 different thicknesses of LNAP in the soil in those boreholes. The next column is the total measured LNAP saturation in each one of those boreholes. And the column next to it is below the oil-water interface. Now, if you remember from the previous slide, it looked like there was quite a bit of LNAP above the oil LNAP interface. So there is some LNAP in the vadozone. In the paper, they think that there's been a drop in the water table, so there's some non-equilibrium which has occurred, and that LNAP in the vadozone is going to drain in. So their total LNAP here is always greater than the LNAP below the air oil interface. So you can compare those numbers as you move down through the column for the different boreholes. If you look at the next set of curves, the next three columns, these are the estimated specific volumes or from the calculations. The column which says range from all samples is the range that you would get of calculated specific volumes from the capillary pressure curves that would occur. So in the previous one, it's the range of volume of specific volumes that you would calculate from the figure on the left-hand side. The average value that you would that you get there is the average from that range of samples. So I'd ask you to compare, if we look at borehole number 10, the average is 5.5, and compare that to the measured values of 6.4 and 4.2. You're somewhat in the middle. The next one is 4. You're going from 6 to 1.2. The next one's 14, which is kind of out of bounds of the 9.7 and 5.2, off by a factor of about 50%. Maybe a factor of 3 if you look at the 5.2. If you had taken the layered profile, you get values of 4.7, 3.5, and 13.7, pretty close to the average. I mentioned earlier kind of a rule of thumb that some of us use to, if you looked at the ulnapple thickness in the monitoring well, let's say it's 100 centimeters, I said you divide by 4, that would give you a value of about 25 for the ulnapple thickness in the soil. And you compare that value with any of the values that you would have from the measured and from the characteristic, and you can see that you're off by quite a bit. So the calculated value, what we're trying to say here is that the calculated values, even though they're not exact with the measured values, is a much better estimation of the amount of LNAP which is in the soil that you would get from a rule of thumb. Moving on, here I'm going to talk about an LNAP recovery rate in a fluctuating water table. The lithology here is a medium sand to about 17 feet, and then a very fine sand below that from 18 to 35 feet. The recovery here in the LNAP occurs in the medium sand. The recovery here is apparently steady for 5 years, but as you'll see, there are large fluctuations in LNAP thickness in the monitoring wells and large fluctuations in short-term recovery rates. And our goal here was to really optimize our recovery system. I kept on asking the consultants here, why don't we keep the recovery at the higher rate? Why does it dip down often to the lower recovery rate? The site, we had a pumping well, which in this case is labeled IBR2. These are kind of the flow arrows that you see for flow towards the well. It's really not contoured correctly. The thickest part of the plume is actually should be at IBR2, but the LNAP is pumped off here, and it's not included in the contouring which takes place. The darker areas is where the LNAP is the thickest. In this figure, we have LNAP recovery and LNAP thickness as a function of time. Time axis is on the bottom. On the left-hand margin, we have the LNAP thickness that occurs, and you can see it varies from maybe 1 foot up to about 8 feet. A couple of lines are drawn where the majority of data occurs, probably between 4.5 and let's say 7 feet of thickness is maybe a typical fluctuation range for the well. The red curve is the LNAP recovery rate over time. Its average value is about 25 gallons per day of recovery, and you can see on the left-hand margin about 45,000 gallons have been recovered of LNAP here in July of or maybe October of 2001. Over that time frame, the water flow rate was kept relatively steady at about 15 gallons per day. The next slide, slide number 70, shows you the range of distributions which were calculated for from different soil samples which were taken from different layers and different soil borings near this IBR2. You might say that in some ways it's very typical to what Dave Huntley and his students saw at the San Diego site. There's a range of different saturation distributions which occurred here. The dark squares, the triangles, the diamond shapes are saturation measurements which were taken from the wells close by to the pumping well. So you can see that the range of saturations that were measured. The black curve is an average curve that was put through the data by various techniques. And you can see that the measured saturation, LNAP saturation, hits about the maximum that was measured. And if you look at kind of the thickness of the saturation distribution with depth, it fits about the thickness of the measured saturation with depth. On this curve, slide number 71, there's several different curves and quite a bit of data, so I should take some time to walk through it. The left-hand margin is the LMAPL recovery rate with time, so it's in terms of gallons per day. And the little blue dots, or diamonds, are the recovery rates over time, actually over cumulative production. On the bottom margin, what's printed out is the cumulative production over time. We didn't show you before, but you can go back to the more comprehensive training on the website. But instead of plotting the x-axis versus time, it's just plotted versus cumulative production versus time. So you remember we recovered about 45,000 gallons over about a five-year period of time. You might look at the x-axis as time or cumulative production rate. The production rate varies from about 10 gallons per day. There's some points down around 10 gallons per day, up to about 40 gallons per day. Maybe there's some that might spike up to 70, and there's some that dip down to 3 gallons per day. But the majority of it varies between 10 and 40 gallons per day. The red dashed curve is the best fit, trend line fit, through the data. And the blue solid curve was from that compiled curve, that average curve that was put through the saturation data, the capillary pressure data, for all those different soil cores that we have from around here. And you can see that we're doing a fairly good job of predicting the average recovery rate over time. It's somewhere around 25 gallons per day over about a five-year period of time. We don't hit the fluctuations. If we looked at about a product thickness, and that corresponded to about 5 feet of product thickness, 5.5 feet of product thickness in a well. If we look at about 4.5 feet of product thickness in a well, we're hitting it at around 10, maybe 10.5 gallons per day at the bottom brown curve. And if we looked at about 5.5 feet of product in a well, you're hitting the upper level curve, which is about the 40 gallons per day. So the middle curve, the blue curve, is at 5 feet of product thickness. I'm sorry, I misspoke before. So what we see here is that as the water table fluctuates, we get recovery rates that vary between about 10 and about 40 gallons per day. So we think that in this case, our water table fluctuation is causing our fluctuation in production rates over time, and we're going to hit about an average over time of about 25 gallons per day. Using this information, we've been trying to optimize our recovery. We've got a flow rate here of about 25 gallons per day, and we're designing other recovery systems to try and increase the recovery rate from this large plume, to recover the plume somewhat quicker over time. But we have a better understanding of our recovery rate over time and our fluctuating rates over time, and that was the goal of what we were trying to do with this study. Our next case study looks at practical limits of recovery. The situation here is a closed refinery with a preliminary reuse plan. It's kind of that situation where all of the above ground refinery equipment has been removed, and the community is looking to possibly reuse the site for other industries. The lithology is a clay. We think it's a fractured clay. It's got 15 feet of product in a well in a potential reuse area. The depth to the potentiometric surface is about 8 feet. The LMAPL, as in many clay sites, can be removed rather quickly, but refilling the well takes to 15 feet, takes a month or more. We wanted to know what is the realistic expectation in terms of recovery and rate, and when can recovery cease. So again, a slide with a lot of data. On the left-hand side of the figure is the effective elevation of the site, and on the x-axis is the LMAPL or hydrocarbon saturation. increasing from zero towards the right. The there's a line through the middle, a thick line, which is labeled range of LNAPL staining in the boring log. And my colleague Mark Adamski had the consultant core very deep below the water table. You can see the potentiometric surface, the historic water level range goes with the turquoise line for about 755 to about 758, or about 3 feet of elevation thickness. In this case, we cored, or Mark cored, to about 739 elevation. So he took a lot of core, and he saw LNAPL staining across this entire range. Now, in a lot of sites, people talk about, well, LNAPL is drawn below the water table because of fluctuating water table, but you can see our historic range is only 3 feet, yet we found LNAPL staining 15 feet below the water table in this case. The LNAPL thickness in the well is 15 feet, as I mentioned on a previous slide. That's the green kind of crosshatched curve to the right. And there you can see the amount of LNAPL staining in the well was slightly greater than the range of observed LNAPL that we currently see in the well. Mark cored this well. He then took saturation distribution saturations in various parts, and those are the black diamonds that you see in this particular figure. Many of them are zero. There's only three of them that are positive. One of them has a value of about 0.15 or about 1.5% in terms of saturation. From the capillary pressure curves that we measured here and the predictions that we made, we would predict a maximum saturation in this soil of about 2.5%. You might look at this and say, well, this is not very good agreement, but if you look at the next between the measured saturations and the predicted. But if you look at the next slide, we think we have an explanation for this. Now, this core is not from that particular site. This core is taken from the Beaumont clay in Texas, another site in which we have LNAPL, LNAPL situation very similar to the previous slide. And when Mark took this core and slabbed it, what he found was that he had these what we call macro pores, in which LNAPL was oozing out. When he took saturation measurements outside of where you see those white circles, basically he had no LNAPL and it was 100% water. In other words, the water was held very tightly in the matrix of the clay. But in these areas where he had these macro pores, there was oil or LNAPL which was seeping out very slowly from those. So the picture that we have with these fractured clays, and we've seen some pictures of it now, is that the LNAPL is moving through these macro pores or fractures. When it intersects the well, it slowly drains and fills up the well with LNAPL, and in the majority of the matrix here, you have primarily water. So what is the type of recovery that you might expect from this type of situation? If you look here at the figure on the left, this is time versus LNAPL recovery rate, and the blue curve here with the diamonds passing through it is a prediction that Mark made prior to initiating any recovery at this site. The pink curve is the actual recovery which he obtained. Now, this site, the LNAPL at this site is a degraded heating oil. There's basically no volume, no volatiles from the if you put it under vacuum, there'll be no volatiles that would come off. So this particular site used the HYVAC system to recover this LNAPL from this well, the LNAPL in water, and that's the peak curve that you see here. So for about the first six months or so, he was right on in terms of his prediction. Then he got a big blip of LNAPL, which was recovered. He got some more LNAPL, and the recovery rate there of the pink curve kind of matches the recovery rate that was predicted, and then LNAPL recovery rate stopped, and he had a flat line. He actually extended this another 4 or 5 months, and the pink curve was continuing flat. What you can see here is that over about a year and a half period of time, The LNAPL recovery rate was, the LNAPL, total LNAPL recovery was about 150 gallons of LNAPL over about a year and a half period of time. With a HYVAC system, he spent about $150,000 to get this 150 gallons of recovery out. His predicted curve was about 230 gallons of recovery after about 2.5 years was what he would have predicted to get out. The curve on the right is a decline curve analysis similar to what we saw before, and we haven't discussed that in this curve, but again, that would predict about 230 gallons of recovery. At this particular site then, with the discussions with the regulators, the modeling predicted that the wells with 3 feet or less of LNAPL would recover about 3 gallons, but leave about 17 gallons as residual. This was argued to be the practical limit. The agency disagreed with us in this case, at least with the modeling that was done and the ultimate recoveries. The resolution on the site is that no further recovery would take place at wells with 3 feet or less. Recovery would take place until there was asymptotic thickness of the wells at 5 feet or more or less, or we recover product where the wells would be 5 feet or greater in terms of the thickness in the well, and the site reuse plans are going forward. Case study 4, which is developing an LNAPL management plan. This is a requisite site, 250 acres underlain by residual hydrocarbons. 180 acres of the site it was expected that the LNAPL had the potential to migrate. LNAPL recovery was required where LNAPL with the potential to migrate exists within 300 feet of a down gradient boundary. We'll see that in a second. And where LNAPL is a source of benzene to groundwater. We haven't discussed dissolve phase at all in this training, but, you know, benzene concentration in the dissolve phase is often a driver at many of these sites and impacts the LNAPL management plan for the site. And that's, you know, something that the LNAPL Cleanup Alliance is continuing to discuss. The hydraulic conductivity is at this site. It's an alluvial sand, 240 to 350 feet per day. Depth of water is 8 to 12 feet. The LNAPL is a mixture of a number of different products, and currently on this site, they're recovering about 300,000 gallons per year. This is a picture of the site. The colored area is where the LNAPL occurs. The different shades are areas of different LNAPL investigations, so they don't mean very much in terms of LNAPL thickness. A sheet pile wall was placed between the LNAPL and the North Platte River to prevent further migration to the river, and LNAPL recovery is continuing in the colored area. This site was somewhat heterogeneous again. The site was handled somewhat differently than the previous two heterogeneous sites that we talked about. If you look at the figure on the left-hand side, the blue squiggly curve, this is, again, the height relative or an elevation versus LNAPL saturation. And the blue squiggly curve is the fluorescent response from LIF. At this particular site, they were able to develop a correlation between the LIF response and the saturation of LNAPL in the soil. And when they corrected then the LIF for saturation, they got the red squiggly curve, and that would be your LNAPL saturation versus depth or elevation. To work with that, they then fit the red curve, the predicted, the measured saturation, with the API model, and that's the green curve that you see. The green curve was then used to predict conductivity, and the curve on the left shows you the agreement that they obtained between the calculated conductivity from the API model and the test and a tested conductivity that they got from bail down tests. So you can see in the upper right hand corner, there's pretty good agreement for those particular data points between the calculated and the measured conductivity. There's maybe 6 or 7 points in which the agreement is not so good. You know, the measured conductivity and the point at which the L-NAPL fluorescence was obtained are not necessarily in good proximity to one another, and they think that that's the primary reason for the disagreement there between the calculated and the measured conductivity. But this was deemed to be a good enough agreement to go ahead. What they did next was they looked at the L-NAPL thickness in the well and the calculated conductivity, and they across the site instead of getting a contour map of L-NAPL conductivity versus L-NAPL thickness versus area, they did a contour map of L-NAPL conductivity versus area. And the dark blue areas here are where the conductivity is greater than 10 to the minus 2 centimeters per second. The teal area is where the conductivity of the L-NAPL is greater than 10 to the minus 3. The gray area is conductivity greater than 10 to the minus 4th. And the brown area is conductivity greater than 10 to the minus 5th. So there was a negotiation with the agency about where L-NAPL was going to take place, and it resulted in L-NAPL recovery taking place wherever the conductivity of the L-NAPL is greater than 10 to the minus 4th centimeters per second. So the results are that L-NAPL recovery was to be implemented within areas that contain benzene-impacted L-NAPL with an initial conductivity of greater than 10 to the minus 4th centimeters per second. This paper was presented at the NGWA conference in Costa Mesa, I think, 2 years ago. Galen Brubaker is the primary author on it, and they go through the reasoning in terms of recovery rates for technical practicability arguments. Recovery was required over about 46 acres instead of 180, and the process helped estimate the optimum groundwater pumping rates and operating periods for recovery rate estimates. The water that's recovered from this site, right now there's a golf course over this site, and the water which is pumped from this site is treated initially, and then it goes into the water hazards for the golf course on this particular site. Okay, case 5, last case study. Here we have a pipeline release. It was a 7,000 barrel per hour pipeline, 4,900 gallons per minute. The pipeline was carrying sweet Texas crude, which has approximately diesel properties. The release was discovered in about February of 2000. There was a CPTLIF investigation in August of 2000, and then a second investigation in December of 2002. The geology of the site is well-bedded layers of sandy calcareous clay and soft marly sands in beds up to 2 inches thick. The groundwater table is about 15 feet below ground. Hydraulic recovery ranges from about 0.1 to 50 feet per day with an average groundwater flow rate of about 10 feet per year. And remember that value of about 10 feet per year for groundwater flow rate. This figure is kind of a plain view of the site.
Hickman, just say we're on slide 83 now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Sorry, Ellen. You can see where the area of the release is, and there was some excavation to remove L-NAPL impacted soil in that particular area. The roost profile L, you'll see some, you see the pipeline, and it was a roost profile L which was run kind of parallel to that pipeline, which is going to be discussed in the next slide, I believe. Yeah. A lot of information on this slide. The left-hand margin is the depth below ground surface versus the x-axis, which is distance along the roost or LIF profile. First of all, look at the sleeve tip point ratio, which is kind of gray to purplish-colored information on the slide. Where you have a gray type of shading, those are sands, and then clays are kind of the pinkish or purplish type of coloring that you see. So you can see the kind of the geology along the roost profile, which they got from the CPT rig. The turquoise to red are the LIF intensity, and we know that that's kind of the amount of LNAPL that might be inside if we could get a correlation between fluorescence and saturation. But right in the area of the plume, at the high water table mark, is where you would have where you have the most LNAPL. You can see that there's some kind of orangish areas down below the high water table mark and down below the low water table line where the LNAPL has distributed itself below the water table. It has also kind of moved both up gradient and down gradient from L3, which is where the release occurred. We'll talk about more of the up gradient movement in a second. But you can see how it's moved down gradient. It's below the high water level mark, and it's kind of decreased in intensity as it moved, has moved down gradient over a two-year period. This is the release occurred in February of 2000, and this is the Ross profile from December of 2002. So that's about a three-year period of time that it's moved. If we look at the next slide, it's got two product thickness maps, one from August of 2001 and the other one from December of 2002. You can see where the release occurred. And you can see that there's up gradient movement and down gradient movement. When the release occurred and it moves down towards the water table, you have a the gradient that you look at is the air LNAPL surface. So you have a mound that occurs, and so the LNAPL kind of spreads out in somewhat of a circular pattern, and then moves down gradient also with the groundwater flow direction, which is towards the lower right hand corner of the figure. You can see where it was at in August of 2001, and where it was at in December of 2002. After December of 2002, they have not seen any further migration of the NAPL in the down gradient phase. If you look at the next slide 86, they've compiled all their information from wells, borings, the excavation, and other geophysical information. And what they saw was that in the early part, right when this still occurred, they were getting a spreading rate of about 27, 28 feet per day. Remember, the groundwater flow rate was about 10 feet per year. After, in August of 2001, the spreading rate has decreased to maybe about 1 foot per day, and where they're at in late 2002, early 2003, they're getting down towards a spreading rate of basically zero. If you remember the earlier slides that Bob talked about, the plume would spread in a circular pattern somewhat initially and then reach kind of an equilibrium configuration where it's very difficult for it to move further down gradient under the existing groundwater gradient. The air LNAPL interface is fairly steady, and the relative permeability at the leading edge is relatively low because the saturations are low, and there's not a lot of head to overcome the displacement entry pressure, so the plume kind of reaches the maximum extent and doesn't move much further. I should say this is, like with residual, this is an area of continuing investigation on the part of the LNAPL Cleanup Alliance and other researchers, so I'm sure you'll hear more about that in the future. So in summary, LNAPL flow did not follow the groundwater gradient, but rather a radial pattern caused by the release, the mounding of the release. The LNAPL rate, the initial rate of LNAPL movement exceeded the groundwater flow rate by a couple of orders of magnitude during the initial spreading period. Although the plume spread rapidly during the initial stages, it ceased significant movement relatively quickly after a period of 2 to 3 years, and similarly, it wasn't shown. You could go to the online version from the RTDF. The LNAPL gradients were shown to dissipate quickly after the release period. So that's all I have. I think we're pretty much back on time, Ellen.
Yeah, thanks, Vic. We're going to have a question and answer period now, but let's quickly, just click through the last slides. You can see some lessons learned on slide 89. You can see the acknowledgments on slide 90. A notice and disclaimer on slide 91. All the contributors on for this presentation on slide 92 and 93. And then on slide 94, that's where you can link to the additional resources page. So go ahead and do that now, and you can see everything that's available. There's also the comment form on that page, so we request if you have any comments or suggestions, please fill that out. And then we're going to open up the line right now if you have a quick question or two. Okay, we have a couple questions online. Lewis from Aquature in Ottawa had a question. He says he often uses products for pumps or skimming pumps to recover products. Is there a model that predicts recovery rate for this type of technology?
Vic? Alan?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know specifically if there's a model, but one of the slides that we had omitted from this presentation showed predicted recovery rates. So if you go to the full presentation that we have, it shows the effects of or the expected recovery times for things like skimming, for passive recovery, for wells, for a trench. And I suspect in the notes for that it will give a reference for a model. And that's probably in the same general area of the presentation as that complicated mathematical expression that I showed. If the person wants to email me, this is Bob Maxey, they can, and I'll see what I can do to find out about that particular model.
I'm sorry, I had it on mute. When I stopped speaking, I put it on mute for a second. The Charbonneau papers that I published in Groundwater have the models for skimming, and all of that's built into the API spreadsheets and models that you can get from the API site. So, you know, if you go to Groundwater and you search under Charbonneau, the student that worked with him was Johns. I can't remember his fellow's first name, but Charbonneau and Johns, you can find all that stuff in.
Yeah, Vic, I refer them to that one slide that we omitted that showed times for recovery for various models or various unit operations such as skimming or wells or trenches.
Right. What we try to do here is we try to quantify, you know, get a good idea of how much oil is in place, the capillary pressure properties. We start to make some predictions about all the different types of recovery that we can make with skimmers or pumping wells and pumping rates. Hopefully we'll have some data from the site that we truth test those predictions, and then we can vary all these different parameters to try and come up with, you know, an optimum recovery situation for the site.
Okay, great. Joel from Excel Communications in Alabama has a question. Is there an effective way to influence saturation pressure in situ?
Saturation pressure in situ. I think it must be determined by the capillary effects, and I think if you try to put pressure on the aquifer, it's just going to squeeze the water out and it's going to go somewhere else. It's a superficial aquifer. If you had a confined situation, you could probably affect it. I'm not sure I understand fully what the question is.
Okay, well, if you need clarification, you can email Vic. We have Stephen from the Wisconsin Department of Commerce. Can someone discuss or suggest readily available article studies regarding hydrophobic filter pack materials designed for LNAPL monitoring recovering wells? He wanted to know if the articles, papers from Dr. Hampton available through the National Groundwater Association are worthy.
I have not found hydrophobic well screens to provide any benefit for us, and quite honestly, but I myself don't really see a benefit for that. We had
I would like to refer you to the comments that we had when we, the basics training, the RTDF sent that out to quite a number of people for review and comments, state regulatory folks, federal EPA employees, and we had some comments back. There was several comments along those lines, and we did prepare some formal response to those comments. I think that's available, isn't it, Ellen?
Yes.
Yes. So I'd like to refer you to those comments and that response.
Okay, Eric from Retech in Colorado asked, what types of sites typically generate more desirable LIF results? Is it a lithology issue, or what is the controlling factor in the reliability of the LIF technology?
Well, in my opinion, and there's some Retech employees that probably have a different opinion, as I said, a lot of this stuff is debatable. I think the controlling factor is the amount of data that you can collect, and how well the geology, well, the geologies and saturations are matched up. You're pushing a CPT rig through the soil and collecting LIF data as a function of depth and geology, and you got to put a well close by or a boring close by to that LIF point and collect data at exactly those same horizons, and then try to match up the fluorescence with the with the saturation that you measure, and that takes a lot of patience and quite a bit of data to do. So if you had enough money and enough data, you could probably come up with it, but I don't think we have that at most of our sites.
Great, thanks. Let me open up one more time to phone lines. Does anybody have a question on the phone line?
I have a question. I didn't want to ask because I've already asked a lot. But the two questions that I have is the first one about NAPL saturation measurement. I know that there are several methodologies, like Dave Huntley talked about the TPH, there's a Dean Stock, and some people use a equilibrium partitioning and measurement of the total concentration to find saturation. Which one were used in your study that you mentioned, and which one would you recommend? That's the first question. And the next question is about the capillary saturation relationship. You mentioned that you prefer drainage, and I'm familiar with the hysteresis effect of the capillary saturation. And my question to you, how is it conductant? Do you start with a fully saturated soil with the NAPL phase, and then you displace this with water? Or do you have 30% saturation? Is there a standardized methodology for conducting that?
I'm sorry, Lily, what was the first question was?
On saturation. I know there's several methodology to measure saturation in the lab.
We typically use Dean Stark.
Dean Stark, okay.
But I've used TPH measurements also. I would suggest that you, the listeners, go again to the api.org/LNAPL website. There's a report there by Tom Sale in which he goes through, he evaluated all different measurement techniques, and he makes some recommendations and he contrasts them.
Can you give me again the website? It's
api.org/LNAPL.
Okay.
There's a report there that Tom Sale from Colorado State put together for API, but it's just a compilation of all ASTM methods and API methods. There's probably EPA methods there, so you can
I know a lot of them, but nobody recommend one or standardized one that would work with all the models that people are recommending.
Well, you should get the same answer.
Huh?
You should get the same answer, whether you use Dean Stark or TPH or...
Oh, is that... there was a study that showed that?
I don't know of any particular study, but you should get the same value.
I know we should, but I wonder if it's...
I don't have any hesitation. You know, if I have TPH, I'll use TPH. If you have TPH, you got to know you got to have a good density, because
right.
you're going to convert it. You're going to convert it using density and porosity. So there's errors involved in most of the methods that you're not going to get. You know, if it's 5% or it's 6%, does it really make? No, maybe in the clay it might make a difference, but it's probably not going to make too much of a difference. You know, if it's 5% versus 6% or something like that. But so, you know, look through his and pick out a method and use it. If you want to do TPH measurements, you can take TPH measurements next to the Dean Stark and see if you come up with the same number. But you should.
Another partial answer to your question: if you go to the RTDF website and you go to slide 39. Which is a conceptual relative phase permeability function. We didn't present that today. And then all these slides have got notes to them. They describe in there some degree what you're asking about in terms of what saturation of oil to start with. And in that particular experiment, they started with water, and then they later on added a constant ratio of water and napple. And it could be that there is a reference associated with that slide embedded in the reference that would answer your question more fully.
It's just that I know that you come up with different answer if you start with different napple quantity. That's attributed to the hysteresis, and then the question which saturation capillary relationship do you use?
Well, maybe this is a question that should be taken offline. We're sort of running out of time now. Let me give one more opportunity if anybody else has a question.
Beth Rowan with RMT. One more quick question. In your case 5, where you talk about you demonstrated the lack of L-NAPL movement over time after the initial release, the initial distribution of L-NAPL in the subsurface, is that under the assumption of everything essentially reaching equilibrium and no additional L-NAPL releases or no additional changes in hydraulic parameters or anything like that, groundwater flow rates or directions or anything? And along those same lines, has anyone looked at the influence of additional releases on top of an initial release?
This site, it was a pipeline release, and there's no further releases. So it is kind of an equilibrium situation. If you had additional releases on top of it, we would expect that you're going to mound the L-NAPL and you'll probably get further movement. Bob, this is an area that you and EPA have had a lot of concern about. You want to comment further?
I'll just comment on the way I think about it. I mean, obviously, if you have an additional release, you'll have more hydraulic head, and therefore you'll be able to overcome the displacement entry pressure in those pores that didn't allow that before, and you'll obviously have further spreading. Does that make any sense, or it's
I wondered if anyone had looked at this much in terms of, you know, with an additional release, you know, how much of an additional release does it take to overcome that entry pressure? You know, is it 50% more, or, you know, is there some relationship that can be kind of used as a rule of thumb, or is it kind of wide open right now that hadn't really been looked at over the long term? It's more curiosity than anything else.
I don't think it's been looked at. You know, at least I'm not aware that it's been looked at. You might be able to do an investigation with the HSSM model that Jim Weaver from the EPA at Athens lab put together for his PhD thesis under Randy Charbonneau. But it's an area that we've had some questions about, and we are going to have to look at probably more in the future. So it's a good question. I don't know that anybody's done any definitive studies.
Thanks.
Let me close by thanking Bob Maxey from the U.S. EPA and Vic Kremisek from BP and all the participants with the wonderful questions. on their email for Bob and Dick and myself or on the front page. Feel free to continue these conversations and ask other questions. If you didn't get your question answered, either if you're online or on the phone, please send your questions in. And we're going to archive the session so you can download it on the Clue-In website at any point. And like Bob said, there's a lot of notes also that go along with these slides. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you, Ellen.